Welcome back to Arts About.
Show About Art, that's a seamless work of art in itself.
Yes, indeed. And today is a very good example of that, isn't it, John?
It is.
Yes, and Mark Stewart, you here too with us?
I'm here, yes, I'm here. Sorry, yeah. I'm just...
The mischievous Mark Stewart.
The mischievous Mark Stewart is here with us, yes. You are here in the studio Sunday morning with me, Sally Bailey, and Artist in Residence and Cultural Sounding Board, John Baird, and the mysterious Mark Stewart.
And just a brief question. Mm-hmm. Have either of you seen the new sculpture which has been put onto the... Peninsula Link.
I don't go that way, Mark.
I have.
While
yes,
being
I
stuck
have.
Behind someone in the right-hand lane.
Yes.
Yes. The one.
Shall we be talking about that a little bit later?
If you like.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes, okay. I have seen it.
He's raring to go, isn't he?
He certainly is. Arts About is, of course, brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. What are you going to talk about this week, John?
Daguerreotypes.
Oh, I love that word.
Hmm. That's
yes.
the very reason I want to talk
is
about
it?
Them.
Good.
That's right. The name of the man who...
Yeah, Daguerre. What was his... How do you pronounce his name in French?
Daguerre. As his silhouette, that was the name of the guy.
Oh, was it really?
Mm. So I'm going to talk about Alfred Felton, Hokusai, which I saw, which was amazing.
Hokusai.
And pig sex.
Oh, that is an unusual list of things. Alfred Felton, what was the second one?
Hokusai,
of course,
and
yes.
pig sex, which is a brief, but you'll be find it very interesting, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to all of those things. Also, we're going to be talking with Gerard Van Dyke from Melbourne-based dance theatre company called Cage. The Rosebud Secondary College have partnered in a unique collaboration with them to unpack the complexity of belonging in a show called To Belong or Not to Belong. It's going to be at the Southern Peninsula Arts Centre on Tuesday, September the 19th. We're also going to be talking with Helen Cassidy, who has a show on at Fringe called Erotic Intelligence for Dummies, which sounds like a lot of fun. It's been a sellout all over the place, and she's going to talk us through a little bit about that. So I think we should listen to some music while we get two of them on the line. What, you've got something for us this morning,
well,
haven't you, Mark?
As people might know, Steely Dan, the lead singer, died recently.
What was his name?
Dan something, I forget his name.
Okay.
And the name Steely Dan comes from a famous dildo from William Burroughs' Naked Lunch.
Really?
Yes, I knew you didn't know that.
No. So that's amazing, I never knew that.
I'm learning.
That's all I know about it, so
what are we going to hear?
Ricky, don't lose that number.
Fabulous. The Fringe season is almost here, and with it a plethora of new shows to amuse, challenge and entertain us all. Among them is one that's bound to titillate the fancy of many, Helen Cassidy's latest offering, Erotic Intelligence for Dummies. The Journal in UK has called her a living, breathing goddess, and the award-winning actress and clown Helen Cassidy takes a long, hard, cross-eyed look at the complexities of intimate relationships, exploring how we can get better at them, the myriad styles of multi-love and our true animal nature. Blending philosophy, dress-up, song, puppetry and balloons into a scandalously layered trifle of love, Cassidy creates the ultimate bonding session. She's with us this morning to enlighten us further. Good morning, Helen. Welcome to Arts About.
Good morning, Sally. Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Helen, the For Dummies series has been extremely helpful for many activities, helping to transform the hard to understand into easy to use.
Right.
You bring us a new one in this series. It's one that I probably wouldn't have expected, Erotic Intelligence. How can we benefit from the simplification of that?
Well, you know, when you simplify complex things like intimacy and relationships, I think it helps to remind us, of fundamentals of life. Love, sex, they're fundamental, just like breathing and food, and you know, it's one of the basics, but it gets all too complicated these days, I find. So in making this show, it's really an exploration of reminding us that pleasure is a human right, really. That the idea of pleasure and sexuality is something that we are born with. It's one of our fundamental rights and it's part of our essential human nature, and sometimes we overcomplicate it with society's views on what a perfect relationship is, or what love and sex should look like, and who you're allowed to have sex with and who you're not allowed to have sex with. And, you know, God, we're hearing about it so much at the moment with the marriage plebiscite and this, you know, crazy situation that we're in with the government trying to tell us who we can marry and what, and who we should love and not. So really, it's a very gentle, light-hearted, ridiculous show that... it's a beautiful show to perform because people come in somewhat terrified and leave with such a warm glow. It's all about connection and love at the end of the day.
That's wonderful. I'm not surprised they come in terrified. I looking through your blurb on the Fringe Festival page that you've got there, you've mentioned some pretty great sexual archetypes. For example, can I mention a swinging polyamorous unicorn, which is a single that dates couples?
Yeah.
A celibate sublimating ascetic who's not into sex. And I've got to say, my education was recently enlarged by learning about furries who identify themselves as animals. Do you know? I mean, I'm assuming you've probably got some of those in the show too, have you?
Well, you might. You might find that I myself might be a bit of a furry, possibly. I'm not going to give away anything. But, you know, the thing is that the part of my research for the show is reading all this. There's so much fabulous literature out there, but there's also, you know, the community and the... we love to label things, humans, don't we? So, you know, everything's got a name, and it's hilarious. A lot of it I find just really funny. And that's part of it's also looking at this whole movement in polyamory, which is essentially what people have been doing for years, really since the 60s and 70s, and it became popular to have open marriages and whatever you would call it, the swingers' parties, and the, what would they put it, the keys in the...
Keys in the bowl, yes.
You know, keys in the bowl, you know, all this kind of thing. But there's a bit of a movement around this idea of polyamory at the moment. And God knows with the divorce rates and the infidelity statistics being so out of control, there's clearly something needs to change within the whole monogamous ideal. It's not working for a lot of people.
Yeah, it does sound a little bit like monogamy is dull and out.
Yeah.
Certainly in your show.
Yes, I'm just so on trend.
Well, you're also a classically trained actor, a circus performer, and a clown as well.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a jack of all trades. I started off sort of at straight acting school and then quickly discovered a love for physical theatre, and so that took me into kind of some circus training, and then that took me into more of the European styles of physical theatre. So I went to Europe and studied with some great mime and clown teachers, namely Philippe Gollier, who's quite renowned now as a bit of a legendary clown teacher. So, yeah, I've spread myself around the place. So you kind of have to do that in this career. You know, you've got to be able to jump in and do a bunch of stuff.
Of course. I saw on the listings that you've done Shakespeare and burlesque and, all sorts of other things as well. I also saw on the YouTube link on the Fringe listing your extraordinary balloon swallowing sequence. Is that part of this show?
That's led to a bit of a balloon theme in this show. So, if any balloon lovers, I do children's parties.
Oh, my goodness.
As a furry or?
Why not? Uh-huh. Oh, look.
Sorry, Helen. Hi, Helen. It's Mark.
I'll do
yes. What sort of furry are you?
Oh, well, you have to come to the show. I don't want to give it away.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, well, fair enough. You've been
what
at the Fringe...
What sort of fairy are you, Mark?
Yeah, that's what we're
lion.
A lion, that I can imagine.
Oh, a lion. How?
Now, this show has had a very successful run so far. You've been at other fringes and festivals around the country, I think it's been a bit of a hit. I've read some pretty spectacular reviews.
Yes, it's been great. It was a huge season in Perth, a big long season in Adelaide for the Fringe, and actually after Melbourne I bring it to the Brisbane Festival in my hometown, which I'm so excited about.
That's great. And do you think you'll take it further afield overseas next?
I hope so, yeah. I'd really love to take it to the UK.
Yeah.
We'll see. Baby steps.
So, oh, that's fantastic. Do you enjoy the Fringe circuit? I mean, the Fringe is pretty fabulous for artists developing new works, isn't it?
It's my first time doing a solo show at the Fringe. I've been on and off the circuit for a while. And it's self-producing is it can be pretty stressful. And the risks are quite big, but also the gain's really big and you're in control of your art on the Fringe, isn't it? That's a really beautiful thing, and you can kind of create and nurture your own audience, and that's also really, really special. And it's just filled with fabulous people, great artists doing their own thing. It's really inspiring.
So the show that you've got on at the moment, Erotic Intelligence for Dummies, it's on at the Arts House, which is in North Melbourne, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the North Melbourne Town Hall.
Fabulous.
I don't know. Melbourne, yeah,
okay.
Typically. But yeah, the North Melbourne Town Hall turns into one of the Fringe hubs.
And when people come along, what can they expect? It's a one-woman show.
It's comedy. It's clowning. There's some songs thrown in for good measure. There's some dress-ups. There might be some audience participation. Maybe. If you're lucky. You know, nobody's going to get away unscathed.
Oh, that's
untouched.
That's fantastic and terrifying.
I guarantee.
Helen.
Yes.
There's a certain type of young man who likes to wear a sort of flannelette shirt, pair of jeans, and work boots, which my daughter identifies as lumber sexuals. I
really?
Wonder if there'll be any of those going on.
I like that. I cater to them.
Yes, I'm sure.
Well, it sounds like it's finally becoming okay to be different in this world now. If any of us do have an unusual fetish, are we likely to leave encouraged to continue it, or maybe
definitely? I think that's actually really what it's celebrating. I mean, erotic intelligence is the ability to kind of keep your intimate life alive and creative, and how to nurture your intimate life, which we're not taught in school or anywhere. Let's face it, it's something there's Esther Perel is a very famous sex therapist, and she's educating a lot of people on erotic intelligence. She coined the term. And yes, it is. It's about embracing things like, well, what does turn me on? What is my kink? You know, a lot of us don't ask ourselves these questions. We think that's only for people on the fringes of society, maybe, or, you know, it's not something we really explore. And hopefully this show will inspire people to go, hang on, maybe I am into a bit of that. Maybe that's not such a bad thing.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah, great.
But will it be enough? That's the problem.
Well, who knows, Mark? Erotic Intelligence for Dummies is on at Arts House during the Fringe. Have a look through the Fringe website for the listing. I'll, of course, post a link to it on our Facebook page so you can see some of the reviews and the YouTube and read a little more about it. We also have been given by your PR company, Helen, two double passes for the 15th of the September opening show, which is at 7:45. If any of our listeners message me on our Facebook page where they see that link to the show, I'll make sure we get your names on the door. Thank you so much for talking to us today. It sounds like a great show. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me, Sally.
Wonderful to talk to you today. Thank you very much, Helen. See you later.
Bye.
Cage was established in 1997 by Victorian College of the Arts dance graduates Kate Denborough and Gerard Van Dyke, who formed a creative partnership with a shared desire to create original works to progress the form of dance. By collaborating with artists and communities, they find original ways to present it in new contexts. And we've talked to Caged in the past, co-creator Kate Denborough, about a production that came to Rosebud a couple of years ago called The Team of Life at Southern Peninsula Arts Centre. And now, thanks to Creative Victoria's Artists in Schools program, Gerard Van Dyke from the company have come to Rosebud Secondary College and have partnered in a unique collaboration to unpack the complexity of belonging. Students from the Rosebud College Performing Arts Stream specialised program that aims to broaden students' understanding of theatre making while providing opportunities for arts engagement present this year's project. It's called To Belong or Not Belong and centres around the question, what do you have to go through to belong? Gerard Van Dyke, who's facilitating the project, is a performer, director, choreographer, puppet master, actor and teacher, and he's with us on the line this morning to talk about this fantastic initiative. Good morning, Gerard. Thanks for coming on Arts About this morning.
Morning, Sally. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Gerard, before we get on to this great production that's coming on the stage at Southern Peninsula Arts Centre on the 19th of September, tell us a little bit about what it is that CAGE does.
We are a 20-year-old creative relationship, really. Kate Denborough and I met while studying at the Victorian College of the Arts, then we just discovered we had a very similar aesthetic, which incorporated humour and really raw kind of physicality and an astute design element. And then after the course, we just met up and said, hey, let's make something together. We made a show, then we made another one, and then we made another one, and by then we were a company. and then we just sort of kept going and going, and we would generate pretty much a new work every 12 to 18 months. Since then, we've toured around the world, and we've made shows that are presented in regional parts of Australia, as well as mostly in Melbourne. But dance theatre is what we call what we do.
Okay, so to belong and not belong sounds as if it might be a rather existentialist expansion of Hamlet's conundrum, is it?
Yeah. Well, Anthea McKenzie, who is the drama teacher at Rosebud Secondary, is really my main source of inspiration on this. When she approached me to join forces with her in the sort of context of an artist school residency, we decided that at the age of early adolescence, which was the year group we were going to be working with, there's identity is really just blossoming, and we decided that we would make a work which might even help, I guess, young performers find a voice, find a way, find a rationale for themselves. So yes, it might sound a little existential, but it's a little bit more about community and where you see yourself fitting in. I've always thought that the future generations are probably going to be just more intelligent than former generations in general, and it'd be nice to be part of allowing that to happen and then fostering that.
Why do you think why will future generations be more intelligent? Are they more informed or connected?
Maybe. I think that more civility over time. You know, if you look back historically, humans were a less civilized society than we are now. We're much more accepting and tolerant of difference now than we kind of ever have been. So that's, I guess, the metric I would look at that through.
So the methodology that you're using is you're coming in to do a series of workshops, I think, with these students. Are you actually creating the work with them, or are you rehearsing an already written piece?
No, we're creating. It's a self-devised work. Yep. I came into it wanting to impart some of my own practice with the students. I thought that would be an eye-opening for them. And so we've been coming up with the material together. I've been questioning them about different aspects of the way they perceive the world, and then we've been using their responses as the content for the work.
I know you've been doing this similar kind of work like this with students before. How do you find this way of learning for them? I mean, does it have an ongoing impact? What can you measure that?
That is difficult, but I remember being kind of in their shoes in my adolescence, and being inspired not just by individuals but by a way of thinking about being creative. And I'm kind of a bit more interested in influencing them with that, a bit like symbiosis. You know, they're exposed to this way of thinking, perhaps this way of being creative, and that in turn can feed them going forward. I mean, some of the students there are really keen on embarking on an arts you know, career, some sort of performing arts career. And so as much as possible, I'd like to be a positive, I guess, guidance or image for them as they, you know, as they start to imagine what it could be like to have that kind of life.
Mm-hmm. And not to mention the camaraderie and the belonging that is created by actually working together on a project like that and supporting each other through it. It's I've seen it work in so many ways with certainly with my children, but also in the work that I've done. I'm a theatre maker too, Gerard. It's a very exciting project, and we're very lucky, really, to be having it pushed so hard by the project coordinator and drama teacher, Anthea McKenzie, down there at Rosebud High School, or Secondary College, I probably should call it. So To Belong or Not Belong, it's going to end up as a final piece that's presented at the theatre there. I think it's September the 19th, isn't it?
That's correct, yep.
How do people go along, and can you buy tickets, or is it just open to the school community?
I'm pretty sure the school has it advertised, but otherwise I suspect if you're really keen you could just arrive on the night.
Yeah.
And
tickets available at the door. I'm just reading through my notes actually. And proceeds going towards the Crisis Centre in Rosebud. I will of course put a link on the Facebook page for Arts About for our listeners so that they can get a direct link in through there. It's terrific. It's a great initiative. Thank you so much for talking to us about it today, Gerard Van Dyke.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
See you later. Bye.
Bye.
Benin funk and soul musician Theophile de Reggio, known to most as El Reggio, along with his crackerjack band The Commandos, blends American R&B, soul and funk with rumba, Latin percussion, wah-wah guitar, wild accordion, thick bass lines and traditional tribal rhythms. It's from the mid-60s through to the early 70s. Here is Feeling You Got.
So it is. Daguerreotypes.
Yeah.
From Mr. Daguerre, and it didn't...
Monsieur Daguerre.
Monsieur Daguerre. And interestingly, he was preempted somewhat by another Frenchman, a guy called Nicéphore Niépce, or someone like that.
Oh.
But he came up with a process using asphalt instead of the treated silver plate, and it worked. Through a camera obscura, you could get an image onto a plate and the light would burn the image onto the plate, and you could then fix the image, although fairly precariously. But the problem with it was that it took about 8 hours of sunlight to burn the image onto the plate, and in 8 hours, the passage of the sun meant that there was no form in any of the images because the light had struck shapes all the way around. There were no shadows. And so they were quite difficult to read, the images. This guy actually, not only did he come up with that process, but also a very early internal combustion engine and a two-wheeled mobility device, a bicycle essentially, with two wheels the same size that you'd sort of scoot along with your legs. So this is a guy who's invented cameras, motor cars and bikes.
Good heavens. Yeah. He was quite an inventor.
Quite an inventor. But he, Daguerre was working on silver plates to be able to make images on. And what they'd do is get a copper plate and they'd put a skin of silver over the surface of it. And then if you treated that with a fume of... Oh, no, do you know, Mark, what the fumes might have been?
No idea, John.
Some chemical concoction... And they'd treat the surface of it and then put it into a box with the light coming in, a camera obscura. And a couple of minutes would do to burn the image onto it. And then they could fix the image with another fumigation of some sort. But they were quite... they weren't very solid physically, you know. You could run your finger across it and disturb the image. So they would have to then... put them behind glass, fairly well sealed, so that...
the finished product.
Mm.
Oh.
So the plate was the finished product. There was no...
Oh, I see.
You didn't print off the plate.
Right.
The plate was the finished product. But they were very popular, and Daguerre and his mate got together and they were trying to figure out some way of making money out of it. And they we're going to offer small subscriptions to lots of people who perhaps would get an image in return, but so pre-sell and in fact crowdfund was what they were thinking of doing. But it seemed like that wasn't going to work. So they went to the French government. The French government said, all right, well, we'll buy it off you. Rather than you patent the process, we will buy the process and the French government will give it to the rest of the world.
Oh.
And it was part of what the French were sort of prone to do in those days, I think, and they made a gift of this to the rest of the world, except for England, Wales and some of the Channel Islands, which had been preempted by a guy called Dick Baird.
A relation?
I hope so. He preempted the gift by setting out a patent for a similar device through the Channel Islands
How
and
incredible.
England and Wales. And he had an American man come over and they started making images that for public, so portraits, but they were much smaller. They were like miniatures. They were making little miniature images. And these were, because they were so fragile, they'd make the image and then they'd put it in a box, in a fold-out sort of frame, so that the box would be on the shelf. You'd open the box, you'd fold out the lid within it, the inner lid, and that would hold up the outer lid and the image would be on the front of it. And so it's holding itself up with the image on the front, not unlike an iPad, actually.
How incredible.
Yeah, it's really quite amazing what they did with all of this stuff. But it didn't last very long because it didn't take very long for people to realise that they could use the same process on paper. And paper was a lot... The ink would, in fact... bleed into the paper and you'd have an object which was a lot more resilient and permanent. Mm. And so there aren't many left daguerreotypes. There's 25 around the world, apparently.
Is that all?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because are they continuing to disappear? Or
They're too fragile. Mm. They just don't last very long at all. Mm. But one of the problems with them and with the continuing use of a direct transfer of light onto a surface was that when people really wanted to make cityscapes and landscapes and that sort of thing, but the image, of course, was in reverse because they hadn't figured out how to use a mirror within the device. And that happened in America. The Americans came up with a process where they could... the image would hit a mirror and then hit the work and would be, therefore, the right way around.
Well, interestingly enough, I watched a film only last night, which I'd love to talk about, but I know I'm going to run out of time and I don't want to take up too much.
No, please
but
don't.
It was called Tim's Vermeer, and it was a film about an American inventor, because this sort of technology, the relationship between technology and art and how things are actually developed is fascinating. But this American man developed that mirror, worked out exactly how Vermeer painted his paintings using something like this, a mirror on a stick and a camera obscura. Mm. And he was not a painter at all, couldn't paint at all, but he actually painted that incredible painting of the music lesson that Vermeer painted, full size, and it was absolutely extraordinary using this technique. I have to talk about it later. It's really, really fascinating. Anyway, that's an amazing...
The mirror was
integral to
it. Reminded me of your mate Michael Bladen,
right,
who showed me a camera that he'd built, a film camera, which looked exactly like a 16mm film camera that you could point down a street, but it had... concealed within it a small digital camera which was pointing sideways down the other street.
Yeah.
So that the people who thought they were being filmed weren't.
Oh no, the master of subterfuge he was. So Mark.
So moving on.
Thanks John.
Vermeer, I don't know if you know, he had 11 children. He was married to an elderly woman who was older than him. Very wealthy, and he only painted 32 paintings in his life.
Yeah, I think there's 20-something existing.
Right.
Yeah.
So he didn't do a lot. But the camera obscura was a major
And this film, I can't recommend it more highly because it's absolutely fascinating. You actually discover absolutely how he did it. Mm. Truly amazing.
Well, the camera obscura, just freaked everyone out when they started doing it, and it took and that was very early on in the Renaissance, before the Renaissance, in fact, they were using camera obscuras. But they thought that this was the benchmark of civilization, being able to portray something with perspective and distance.
Mm.
It took until the 20th century and Pablo Picasso to realise there are other ways of making art.
Duchamp also?
Oh, well, Duchamp, yes.
Okay, we better get on to you, Mark, otherwise we're going to run out of time.
Okay, so I'm going to begin with Alfred Felton, who... As you all know, the Felton Bequest is a very big part of...
Well, good on you for doing the research. We were talking about this last week.
We were, John. That's why I move on to these things quite quickly.
So you're, in fact, not spending all week sitting around playing either of your pianos?
No, or rolling joints. So he was born in East Anglia in 1831, arrived in Victoria in 1853, went to the goldfields and realised that he could make more money as a merchant than digging for gold.
That's a familiar story.
Yep. And he died in 1904 at the Esplanade Hotel in St Kilda,
John.
Did he? Yes, he spent the last 12 years of his life there.
Did the fumes coming off the carpet kill him?
There was probably no carpet in those days, John, I think.
Would have been a lino, wouldn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, he was unmarried, no children, no gay lovers. Mm. He established two major bequests, one for the relief of less fortunate fellow citizens and the other for the cultural edification of the community in which he lived. The income from his bequest has since been devoted in equal shares to charities and to the purchase of the MGG for the NGV of works of art calculated to raise and improve public taste.
Including the Valdosta, Sally.
Including the Valdosta.
I wonder, John, if we're going to get a mention of that painting every single show.
Well, maybe he could actually describe it to us. Anyway, the gallery suddenly gained access to acquisition funds greater than those of London's National and Tate Galleries combined, which was pretty amazing at the day. And between 1904 and 2001, more than 15,000 items were purchased. Their estimated value in 2002 was around $1.5 billion. Felton's way of life was always seasoned by a moderation that amounted to frugality and a simplicity that was akin to humility.
Right.
So he was quite an amazing character, and he is, as you can, when you look at all the major paintings in the NGV, it's quite an extraordinary collection.
They went mad on Italian and
Their first purchase,
other European sort of masters.
Yeah, the first purchase was Camille Pizarro's Boulevard de Montmartre.
Well, that was pretty adventurous.
It was in 1905. Mm. It's not bad. So while I was in the NGV, I saw the Hokusai, which was probably one of the best shows I've seen all year.
Oh, really?
It is worth seeing. It is extraordinary. Quite a large show, because it's not just the 36 views of Mount Fuji. There's the bridge sequences series and the waterfall series.
Oh, okay.
And it's a very well mounted, very well spaced, and there weren't too many people. And when you only have to pay $12 as a member for the Hokusai and $22 for the Dior, the choice is made very quickly. Now, the thing about the Hokusai is that we have a great wave, which was bought by the Felton Bequest in about 1910, I think. And there's only 2,000 examples made of every print, because this is what...
They're still quite big editions, aren't they?
Yeah, but there's still, that's 2,000. The first 200 are considered to be the best. The rest, it just gets, they fade away.
The wood wears out.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the first, because there's two great waves there now. There's one from Japan and there's one from the Felton Bequest. And they say the Felton Bequest one is the better one because it was about number 22 or something.
Okay. So the great wave... being that particular image with Mount Fuji in the background, part of the
36 views of Mount Fuji, which he did more because they were so popular. Mm. One of the things about Hokusai is that he was one of the first Japanese to see Dutch prints and Dutch paintings, and so he realized that the European idea of perspective was actually quite interesting. He also discovered Prussian blue, which they didn't have in Japan. And his gradations of the use of Prussian blue were just extraordinary. They really have some of the prints are just astoundingly beautiful.
Mm.
Definitely worth seeing.
So from the West to Japan and then, of course, back to the West.
That's it.
Hokusai became very popular in
with,
the West.
With and his bridge, Degas and all the rest of them.
Well, his bridge images really influenced a lot of stuff that, for instance, Singer Sargent and also Mies the Weasler.
And Van Gogh.
And Van Gogh.
Anyway, so we're running out of time.
We're running out of time and we've got to move on to peak sex, don't we?
Okay, so this is the thing. Now, as you know, Sally, men ejaculate 50 mil of sperm when they come. As Catherine the Great knows, horses 70 mil. But a boar, when it makes love, it ejaculates 250 ml of semen.
Is that because its sperm are a little bit weak and feeble, or they need more of them?
I haven't asked the boar. I don't know, but I don't know the actual reasons. I'll have to tell you that next week. But they've shown, they've seen boars falling asleep while ejaculating because it takes them 15 minutes to ejaculate all that sperm into
the sun. That is boring.
They also have penises shaped like corkscrews, don't they?
They do. They have very funny. I mean, have you seen a kangaroo penis? It's got a little hook on the end.
No.
It's the second time you've mentioned that on an arts program.
It's always good to end with a couple of chuckles, don't you think?
No, but the pig falling asleep, the boar falling asleep while it's making love, I find that very interesting.
Well, I think that would be the definition of a boar.
Hark. It's time for the news. Maggie Diaz's Photography Prize for Women's on at Bright Space and celebrating the life of American-born Maggie Diaz, who came to Australia in 1960 and became one of Australia's foremost women photographers. That's on until the 17th of September at Bright Space.
Fringe Festival is on, opening this week, the 14th of September to the 10th of October. Go to the melbournefringe.com.au and see what incredible things there are. We heard all about Erotic Intelligence for Dummies opening at Art House in North Melbourne on the 15th, but there are many shows in the program, so have a look.
Don't forget that there's also Melbourne Fringe Furniture 2, a showcase of cutting-edge design, I hate that expression, to look at the Rosina Auditorium. So look at the Rosina Auditorium at the Abbotsford Conference as well.
Do you prefer avant-garde, Mark?
No, a bleeding corner.
Okay, very good. Southern Boys Studios have opened in Carbines Way in the Industrial Estate in Mornington with a huge inaugural event last week that I went along to. It houses new studios for a series of artists and it also has a framing facility as well there. They had their first exhibition opening on Friday night last week. It was a great blast, complete with sliders, paellas and some wonderful local wine and beer, as well as an amazing collection of local artists who turned up there. It was quite exciting. We need to get the founding couple in here very soon to talk about their new project because I suspect we'll be hearing good things out of there soon.
They successfully concealed that from you and I, Mark.
Yes,
and me. Well, only my nephew's working there. So anyway, they know about us now. That's good.
Sunday the 8th of October, there's a piano recital by Stephen Casaminas on at McClellan Sculpture Park, inspired by the sculptures there. Drinks and canapes and a tour of the gallery grounds beforehand. You'd be going along to that, I suppose, Mark.
Well, look, I mean, inspired by the sculptures, I really worry what sort of music he's going to make, but anyway, we'll see. BK's opera, La Voix Humaine, opera up close, intimate and unrestrained. Shattered by their breakup, a woman calls her ex-lover. What does she call him? No, it doesn't say. Artistic director Kate Millay brings her distinct sensibilities to this unique opera, turning one of opera's most famous monologues into a powerful ensemble piece. Where is that at?
That is on, it's part of the Fringe Festival. I think you better have a look at the Fringe website for that. La Voix Humaine, is that correct?
La Voix Humaine, yeah.
Yeah, very good. The other thing, have a look at Fanforced Films, folks. This is an organisation that enables listeners to select films you may be interested in and host screenings either at home or in local cinemas. Currently they're promoting Namajira Project, which is a documentary about to have a national release in Australia. It tells the story of the Namajira family chasing their quest to regain the copyright to their grandfather's artwork after being exhibited all around the world and being the first Indigenous person to become a citizen. He was wrongfully imprisoned and died a broken man. The government sold his copyright in 1983 to an art dealer and today's family are fighting for survival, justice and to regain that copyright. And you can support them by hosting a screening or go along and see it or set it up as a fundraiser for the Namajira Legacy Trust, whichever you do. Your support in getting this film and far out and wide is valuable. I think if you have just tuned in, you've missed Arts About. So don't forget, we'd love to hear from you. If you visit and like our Facebook page, you'll find links to some of the things we're talking about on the show and also get a reminder about what's coming up in the next show. We've got two tickets for Erotic Intelligence for Dummies if you comment on that page and give Semi your name. You can find a link to our Facebook page on the RPP website. Join us again 11 a.m. next Sunday, or hear the repeat on Wednesdays at 12, or listen to the podcast on the station website. And remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art,
but we know what we like. Hokusai, apparently.
Hokusai is good.
Thanks, Brody.